What an amazing night, right? It is so good. I feel like I came off real hot right there. Sorry. So hot's not the right word, but whatever. Glad to be here with you. Good start, Kyle. Great start. If you don't know me, I'm Kyle, one of the pastors here at The Crossing. Thanks for the Woo Girls. 2 weeks in a row, Woo Girls. And a little throwback, right? And yeah, I couldn't be more excited to be with you here at The Crossing, kind of back in our space, in our church. And I want you to do something with me for a second. I want you to pull out this card, open that Daniel book, and I want you to pull out this card. And the reason I want to do this is because I think sometimes it's easy to skip over these things, but I want you to flip this card over. And I want you to look at these words with me, because we wrote this because we believe that this is true. Some of you, this is your first time at Veritas, and you're kind of wondering, like, what the heck is this place that has a hot dog truck and a mini golf course and, you know, all the things that are, what is this thing, right? It's a great question. Veritas, it just means truth in Latin. It's Latin for truth, but as you can see, for us, for so many of us, it's so much more than that. Yeah, Veritas is a place. It's a space that we get to gather. We're thankful to have a space where hundreds of us can come together and gather on Tuesday nights here at The Crossing, here at our church. But it's more than a space. It's a group of people. If you stick around long enough at all, you'll realize we're kind of messy people, and by that I mean we're imperfect people. We're people who haven't figured it all out. We're people who have questions and doubts and insecurities and fears and make mistakes and failures. We're people who want to be known and know others. But it's also more than that. It's an opportunity. Veritas is it's an opportunity. It's a chance to worship. It's a chance to connect. It's a chance to learn about Jesus, to learn about ourselves, to learn about God's purposes for our lives. And in this next sentence that we wrote, we say this all the time, whether you've been following Jesus for a long time or aren't sure what you believe about Jesus, we think you're gonna like it here. We think you'll like it here. And even more than that, we think that you belong here. And just like all the people in our church said, you belong here. Just like you saw out in the parking lot, you belong here. You're going to hear us say it over and over and over again. And it's not a cliche phrase. It's not just some tagline that it seems like everybody says nowadays, but it's true. I really mean it. Nick said it earlier, you being here tonight, it's not an accident. I believe that God brought you here, that God wanted you specifically, God wanted you here tonight. I don't know why, but I believe that God wanted you here, that he brought you here for a reason. Even if you don't see it, even if you think, oh, I'm just here because someone grabbed me into a car and said, hey, we're going to this thing, or someone invited you, or you met someone on campus and you're like, well, I'll give it a shot. I heard there's gonna be some fun. Even if you don't know why you're here, I think God brought you here for a reason. It's kind of funny how God works like that in our lives, isn't it? Like God's always up to something. God's doing something in our lives, even if we can't see it at the time. And I think the same thing is true right now, that God is doing something. Again, whether you've been following him for a long time or you're not sure what you think, God is doing something in your life right now in this moment. God's always got the bigger picture in mind. He's always got the bigger picture of your life. And speaking of the bigger picture, I literally wouldn't be here right now if my parents hadn't said no. Literally, I wouldn't be standing here. I wouldn't be at this church. I wouldn't be on stage. I wouldn't be a pastor if my parents hadn't told me no. Now, what am I talking about? Well, some of you know this about me, but a lot of you are new, and so I just wanted to start tonight by sharing a little bit about myself, a little bit about how did I get to this place of being a pastor at this church in Columbia, Missouri at this time. I didn't always want to be a pastor. In fact, most of my life, I didn't even know what a pastor was. I wasn't a church kid. I didn't follow Jesus. I didn't want really anything to do with any of that. And so I certainly didn't want to become a pastor. I came to Mizzou. I wanted to study. I did study civil engineering. I wanted to be an engineer. I wanted to make a bunch of money. I wanted to have a big house. I wanted a boat. I wanted to move back to Kansas City and have all the things. God had a different plan for my life because I don't have any of that now. But here we are, right? And interestingly enough, that bigger picture, that plan, that thing that God was up to, well, from at least an earthly perspective, as I look back in my own story, it started with a pretty big disappointment. And that disappointment was that no that I mentioned, that no that came from my parents. Now, you're probably wondering, okay, what do they say no to? There are a lot of good things that a parent can say no to their kid. What do they say no, Kyle? Well, the thing they said no to me was spending my summer with one of my fraternity brothers down in a mountain village in Jamaica, serving with a local organization. I wasn't exactly hanging out on the beach all summer. I didn't want to go down and kind of have this lavish summer. No, I just wanted to go serve with this local organization in this small village, and they said no. That summer, it was the last summer before my last semester in college. I'd already accepted an internship with an engineering firm in Kansas City, but this opportunity popped up, and it seemed like a great way. Like, who wouldn't want to spend their last summer before they work the rest of their life down in Jamaica? And so I went to my parents with that plan. However, they just didn't see it the way that I saw it. They thought that it was pretty irresponsible. They thought quite honestly, it was pretty stupid. And, you know, looking back, I don't blame them, right? To them, it was irresponsible. I wasn't going to get paid. I was going to have to actually raise a bunch of money to go. I was going to have to call this engineering company that I'd already accepted an internship with and have to kind of say, hey, sorry, I'm not coming anymore. And by the way, this is the company that I wanted to work with, so not exactly a good look. And for whatever reason, though, and now I can look back and I can see God's hand in it all, but back then I didn't know other than I just was kind of stubborn and I wasn't ready to give up. And so what did I do? I called the engineering firm and I said, okay, hey, this is crazy. I called my college recruiter, called the person that hired me and said, hey, I want to work with you guys. But here's the thing. I just got this incredible opportunity to go down and do this thing. And I look back and I'm like, this is so stupid. Why did I do this? But here's the thing. It worked. I'm in this conversation, and she's like, yeah, that sounds amazing. You should go do that. And I'm like, yeah, but I still want to work with you. And she's like, yeah, it's probably fine. No big deal. Well, I'm sure we'll hire you. And I was like, this is amazing, right? Like, problem solved. I'll go to my parents, tell them the great news, which is exactly what I did, but they said, yeah, no. They dug in. And at the time, I was so mad. Unbelievably mad. I was hurt. I was disappointed. It took me a long time to get over. But here's the crazy thing. This is the crazy thing. 2 weeks into that summer, I'm stuck at home. I'm in Kansas City. I'm working at a desk, and I get a phone call, and it's from a guy that I had worked with on a job site in Texas the summer before. And he said, hey, it just so happens that he knew I was from Missouri. He said, it just so happens that I'm on a job this year up in Missouri. He said, you wouldn't by chance still be in Missouri. I'm like, yeah, you literally called Kansas City. I'm in Missouri. And he said, well, it just so happens, you go to Mizzou, right? It just so happens this job is like 30 minutes away from Columbia. And what would you think about coming down and being my assistant project manager for the summer as an intern? I was like, this is amazing. Like, you know, professionally speaking, this is about as good as it gets. And I said, yeah, I want to do it. But here's the problem. I didn't have a place to live. I lived in a fraternity house all 4 years in college. And I, you know, 2 weeks into the summer, didn't have any friends that I could stay with. I had friends. I just didn't have friends that I could stay with. You know, who gives a lease 2 weeks into the summer? I said, so, you know, I don't have a place to live. And that's when that friend that I was supposed to go down to Jamaica with stepped in. He said, hey, what if you, he was actually already in Jamaica. He went. He said, what if you stayed at my house for the summer? I said, okay. And he said, yeah, you can just stay there for free. Just stay. I didn't know any of the guys he's living with. But here's why that matters. That was the house that I lived in that summer. Here's why that matters. Because that house, as it turns out, it was a house owned by The Crossing, which at that time was a church that I didn't go to. And that summer, I got connected to a group of people into a new ministry that the church had started called Veritas that I wasn't a part of. And so that summer, living in that house, I got connected both to The Crossing and to Veritas, and God radically changed my life. 4 months and some details later, I was having a very different conversation with my parents, this time to say, I'm not taking any jobs other than the job here at the church. I tell that story, it's still crazy to me because I just couldn't see it at the time, but my parents' no was just a small part of the bigger picture that God had for my life. It was a small part of the bigger plan that God had for my life. I just couldn't see it at the time, but God was in complete control. And I share that story, one, just to give you a little background on me, but two, to kind of raise a question. And that question is this: what might change about your life if you believe that that was true about your life too? What might it change about your life if you believe that God had a plan for your life? Not a generic plan, a specific plan. What might it change about your life if you believed that God was in control of all the different things that happen in your life? What might it change about your life if you really believed that God really did have the bigger picture, does have the bigger picture for your life, even right now, even if you can't see it? See, I ask those questions because I believe he does. I believe he does. Now, that doesn't mean that it's always going to be easy, right? It doesn't mean that his plan, his bigger picture, it's always going to be comfortable for us. I wish it was. It's not been easy and comfortable always for me. But here's the thing. Here's the thing. The Bible teaches us that even when it's hard, God has a plan for your life that is good. God's plan for your life is good. God's plan for your life is good. If anyone knew that, it's a guy named Daniel. Daniel lived about, several thousand years ago. He lived about 600 BC, about 600 years before the time of Jesus. And the thing about Daniel is that for most of Daniel's life, he lived far from home. But it wasn't by choice, like many of us choose to leave home. No, Daniel was forced. He was forced to live in a foreign land. And we learn about Daniel's story in a section of the Bible called the Old Testament. Now, if you're unfamiliar, one way to think about the Old Testament is that the Old Testament is just the time before Jesus. So it's kind of telling time before Jesus. So like I said, Daniel lived 600 BC, so about 600 years before Jesus, and he recorded for us various parts of his life, various experiences of his life, in what we know as the book of Daniel. And if you haven't figured out already, Daniel, the book of Daniel is going to be our talk series on Tuesday nights this semester. It's gonna be awesome. I love the book of Daniel. Maybe you're familiar with it, maybe you aren't, but it's great. It's full of drama, it's full of visions and at times danger. It reads at times like kind of a thrilling Netflix show. It gets super weird in the second half with lots of visions and apocalyptic stuff. But here's the thing, it's not written to entertain us. Daniel's not written to entertain you. It's not written to entertain me. No, it's written to challenge us. It's written to encourage us. And more importantly, it's written to remind us, to teach us about who God is. Hopefully, when you came in tonight, you were handed one of these. I asked you to pull your card out, so I'm guessing you have this. But we're hoping that this is, you know, our little gift to you. But this is the entire book of Daniel, and we're hoping that this is something for you that you spend your semester alongside us reading through it. We hope that it serves as a place where you can, you know, bring it on Tuesday nights and jot down thoughts, jot down questions, reflection type thoughts that you have. We hope that it's something that, like I said, you bring with you each week. And if you didn't get one, just let one of us know. We'll do our best to get one for you. Okay, let's jump in. Book of Daniel, picking up verse 1, chapter 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into Nebuchadnezzar's hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Now, I'm going to pause because this is so disconnected from our life that it's worth kind of pointing out some things. It's worth highlighting some things. And the first is Jehoiakim here. Jehoiakim, who's that? Well, what we're told is that Jehoiakim is the king of Judah. Now, there's some backstory here, so let me give you just a really quick summary of the kingdom of Judah. So in the Old Testament, God's people used to be one nation. One nation, all God's people. And that one nation was called Israel. But the thing about Israel is that they didn't always do what God told them to do. They disobeyed constantly. They didn't listen. They kind of went their own way. And because of their disobedience, Israel, it splits into two different kingdoms, okay? And so here's a map showing kind of the two different kingdoms. There's a kingdom of, it's confusing because one stays Israel, but, you know, just go with it. So the northern kingdom is the kingdom of Israel. The southern kingdom is the kingdom of Judah. Jehoiakim is the king of the kingdom of Judah. And the thing to know about Jehoiakim is that he's not a very good dude, right? He doesn't follow God. He doesn't do what God says. He doesn't trust God. He does bad things. He goes against God's will. And so what happens is that God allows, go back to verse 2. Notice it says, the Lord gave. It's kind of interesting, right? That there's a bigger picture. It might seem like this king was just defeated by this other king, but notice it says, the Lord gave. God allows Jehoiakim to be given into Nebuchadnezzar's hand. He allows this king of Babylon, this foreign land, to come in, to invade, to overthrow Jehoiakim. And he does this kind of odd thing where he takes some of the things from the temple, that was just like their church in Jerusalem, and he takes it back. Nebuchadnezzar takes it back to his kind of home temple in Babylon, his home church. Now, that's weird because, yeah, it's just weird to us. But in the ancient Near East, it was actually pretty common. It was common for the king of a conquering nation to take something, usually an idol that kind of represented the chief god of this defeated nation, back to his home church. So that's what's happening. Nebuchadnezzar comes in, he takes something from this church of Jehoiakim, and he takes it back to his church. That's what he's doing. But he doesn't just take things, he takes people. Because we continue in verse 3, it says, then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. That's also another way of saying the Babylonians. The king assigned to them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. So again, let me recap, because not only did Nebuchadnezzar take things, he takes people. He takes the kind of Israelite nobility. He takes from the Israelite nobility, and he takes them back to Babylon. And notice that Daniel, it tells us why, because we're kind of wondering, like, why would you do that? Well, just to summarize verse 4 and 5, what we see is he did it to teach them the literature and language of the Babylonians for 3 years. In other words, he takes these Israelites and he puts them through Babylon University. He takes them and he brings them to his homeland, and he puts them through Babylon University. It's this form of kind of cultural indoctrination. He wants these Israelites to assimilate to Babylonian culture, and that's exactly where we pick up Daniel's story. We meet Daniel in the very next verse, verse 6, and among these youths that were taken from Israel, from Judah to Babylon, were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief eunuchs gave them names. Daniel, he called Belteshazzar. Hananiah, he called Shadrach. Mishael, he called Meshach. And Azariah, he called Abednego. So Daniel, just catch this, Daniel and his friends, they're taken from home, not by choice. They're taken, they're forced from home to a new place, but they're also given new names. So they're in a new place and a new culture, and they're given new names. that represent Babylonian culture and Babylonian gods. And so essentially what they are is they're foreigners in a foreign land being forced to assimilate to a foreign culture. And here's the interesting thing. They're roughly your age. They're teenagers, late teenagers. So think about that. Actually, I think it's kind of a relevant question to ask you is how would you feel if that were you? How would you feel if you were forced from home to go to a new place, to go through kind of a new education system, to assimilate to a new culture against your will? How would you feel about the people who ripped you from home? How would you feel about God as all of that is happening, as you're taken away from everything you've ever known, and now you find yourself in this new place for who knows how long? How would you feel? I got a call the other day from a friend, a guy. He was a former Veritas student. He was in a small group that I led. He actually led a small group for Veritas for a long time. He's been following Jesus for a long time. And as we were talking, he just said something to me that kind of, I mean, I think it was why he was calling. But he said to me, he said, "Kyle, I don't know who I am anymore. I don't know who I am anymore." He was telling me all about his life and all the new things. His life had changed pretty drastically. He was in a new job in a new place, trying to make new friends for the second time in less than a year. And so he's away from home. He's away from friends. He feels disconnected, disoriented. He's facing all these different pressures and experiences. And he's just kind of asking me, he's saying, "Look, I don't know who I am." Now, I don't think he was having an existential crisis. I don't think he meant that question with kind of an existential sense. I think what he was trying to wrestle with, what he was trying to articulate to me is he was trying to figure out who he wants to be. Who he wants to be, how he wants to live in this new place that he found himself in. And I could tell that, you know, he was really struggling with those questions. I wonder if you've ever been in a situation where you've had to ask yourself those questions. Who am I? Who do I want to be? How do I want to live? My guess is, of course you have, right? Because all of us have been in situations, in settings where we feel disconnected, where we feel disoriented, where we're kind of away from home or away from our, outside of our comfort zone. Honestly, maybe some of you feel like that exactly right now. You're new to Columbia, away from home, or you're new to Veritas. Maybe you're new, someone said this earlier, you're new to being inside of a church. And it feels kind of strange. It's disorienting. You're trying to figure out what this is. Maybe you're new to a friend group, or maybe you're new to a university or a degree program or a team. I don't know. If it's not those things, it's some other thing, right? And see, what I'm trying to get us to realize is that though our circumstances are different, we can relate a lot to Daniel and those three friends. They too struggled. They too had questions. But the question that I have that I think we should have for them is, okay, but what did they do? What did they do? Well, this is what we read in verse 8. But Daniel, he resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that the king drank. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. Remember, part of the Babylon University was that he would be given food from the king's table. He would be given wine from the king's table. And I think it's interesting, as you read through Daniel chapter 1, you see that up to this point, Daniel and his friends, they hadn't protested this exile. They hadn't protested, at least that we can tell. They hadn't protested their experience of being in Babylon up to that point. Because they don't protest being forced into a Babylonian education, at least not that we know. They don't protest being forced into Babylonian politics, being a part of the king's court. They don't protest even being given new names, Babylonian names that represented Babylonian culture and Babylonian, I mean, their Jewish names represented their Jewish God. And they're given new names that represent new gods. They don't even protest that. No, this is the thing, though. This is where they draw the line in the sand. This is the thing. They won't eat the king's food. They won't drink the king's wine. I'm sure it was good. Probably the best. Why wouldn't they do it? Why wouldn't they eat? Why wouldn't they drink from the king's table? Well, it's because eating the king's food and drinking the king's wine, it was a way, at least back then, of declaring dependence on the king. It was an expression of loyalty and allegiance. See, it was one thing to kind of take on, to learn a new culture, take on a new job, be given a new name, but it was a completely different thing, at least for Daniel and his friends, to declare allegiance to a new king. See, they'd already given their allegiance. They'd already pledged their loyalty. They declared their dependence to a different king, to their creator, to God. And it's worth pointing out, because maybe you're left wondering, well, yeah, that probably wasn't that big of a deal. No, it actually was a big deal, because Daniel had no idea. I mean, just imagine, you're forced into this situation by someone with more authority, more power, the king of the nation that just defeated yours. And the king has an edict, and he says, you will do this, and Daniel says, nah. See, Daniel didn't know what was going to happen. Daniel didn't know, but he trusted. He trusted that God would provide, that God would give him what he needed. He trusted that God had the bigger picture of the circumstances of his life, which is exactly the case, because we read in the very next verse that God gave favor and compassion in the sight of the chief eunuchs, the chief of the eunuchs. God gave Daniel favor and compassion. And here's the thing, we're gonna see this over and over and over again in the book of Daniel, that God continues to give Daniel favor, even in exile, even in Babylon, even away from home against his will. God gives Daniel favor. Why? Because he's got a bigger picture. He's got a bigger plan, and that plan is for good. See, God has a plan for good in spite of their exile. God has a plan for good, hear that, in spite of their exile. And here's why that matters. Here's why I want you to hear that, because it's true for you and me too. It's true for your life too, that God has a plan, a good plan, in spite of being in exile. Now, what do you mean, Kyle, in spite of being in exile? Well, I say that because, you know, one of the main storylines of the Bible is that we're all in exile. That you and I currently, not just because we live in Colombia, not just because you're in college, but in one sense, because we live in, that we're all in exile, that we're all caught in the same tension that Daniel and his friends were caught in. They were left asking what it looks like to follow God in an unbelieving culture. That's the experience of being in exile. What does it look like to faithfully follow God in an unbelieving culture? Which, by the way, it's not easy. It's not easy. What does it look like for us to live faithfully in an unbelieving culture? What does it look like to faithfully follow Jesus, maybe even in college? There are a lot of things that I could say. There are a lot of things that we could talk about. I want to show you, we asked our friend Jordan to kind of share some of his story about what that means to him. So let's watch this.
Yeah, I would say I became a Christian just a few years ago, but my connection with God wasn't the greatest. I believed in a God. I grew up with that kind of background, but at the time just wasn't really close and connected with him, and my priorities were elsewhere. I think the pivoting point for me was when I was involved in all these different things, whether it was partying, drugs, alcohol, sex, whatever it may have been. Every time I would chase after that rush or feeling, it was there. But there was always some empty feeling afterwards with it that just never kept me like fully satisfied. I had tried literally everything else up to this point to kind of give me that satisfaction or that feeling of being wanted or desired. And it always left me feeling short, and so I just took a leap of faith and decided, let's try something else. I originally thought becoming a Christian or like truly committing myself to God would make all those temptations go away, like just like that, like he'd fix that, and that was not the case. I think my urge to go out and party, do all that stuff, the past things that I had done was still there. And I think whenever I chose to turn away from those things or slowly turn away from them, it wasn't a smooth process. I would fall in and out of it. But those people that I would associate myself with would give me a harder time, would ridicule me, would just make fun of me or whatever it may be, just looked at me differently. So that was really hard because I've always been somebody that struggles with having a good community around them. And so it's easy for me again to fall into habits of like, oh, you're not good enough. I think what helped was just remembering the simple promises that God has for us, including that, again, we're made in his image. He loves us no matter what we've done, which again, for me in particular, is really good to know because I feel like I've done every bad thing there is to do out there. And so, and I think just having friends that reflect that love has been super helpful as well for me to come to them in times of need, in times of distress, whatever it may be. And I think the more vulnerable, again, you are with others around you, the more support they're able to give you along the way, because you're not meant to be, you're not called to do this alone in this process. Like, you need people around you to help you with whatever you're going through, the highs and the lows. And watching those people continuously show up for me has helped me turn away from those old ways a lot. There's gonna be bumps along the way. You're gonna feel like you're really on top of it some days, and then a week later you might feel like you're at your lowest point again. But I think it's worth it because, again, I'm someone who just always felt like there's something empty inside of me. And it wasn't until I grew in my faith, connected with God, connected with Christian community, where I felt like I was actually filling that emptiness. And I felt more complete. I felt like my true self. And so it's much easier said than done to do that. Like, there's a lot of steps along the way. It's gonna take a lot of effort and a lot of trials, but I do think it's absolutely worth it because in the end, you have a sense of fulfillment. You feel like you're truly alive in a world that just offers a lot of death, and I'm looking for something that can last long term. That's something that's gonna last for me for the rest of my life. So,
I don't know. Maybe you hear his story and you see a lot of your own story in his. I do. Maybe I share some of that at a later date. Maybe not, though. Maybe for you, your story is different. I don't know your story. But I know that one of the things that he said, it stuck with me. He said that, look, when I started to turn away from, when I started to turn away from the things that were distracting me, when I started to turn away from the things that were, you know, shouting for my loyalty and commanding my allegiance so that I could turn to God, by the way, that's a really imperfect process, isn't it? Maybe some of you know that from experience. But he said when he started to do that, he started to find his true self, which I think is another way of saying he got a better answer for who he was and who he wanted to be and how he wanted to live. See, like I said, I don't know the specifics of your story. I don't know the specifics of your life, but I do know this. I do know this, that God has the bigger picture. God has a plan for your life that's good. And because God has the bigger picture, because God has a plan that's good, even if you can't see it, what he wants from us is he wants us to trust him. It's hard. It's not easy. Following Jesus, especially in college, it's not easy. But just like Jordan said, it's so worth it. It's so worth it. I want to leave you tonight. Maybe grab that journal if you haven't gotten it out yet. I want to leave you with a reflection question. Here's the question. What needs to change for you this semester to live faithfully in exile? I want you to think about that for a second. I don't know. Maybe you think about it right now and you start writing some ideas down even as I'm talking. Maybe I'll create just a second for you to do that. What needs to change for you? What maybe to steal a metaphor, what's the king's food that you need to turn away from? What's the thing distracting you from following God? What's the thing that's saying, no, follow me instead, or give me your allegiance, or give me your loyalty? Like, what's the thing for you that's kind of pulling you away? That maybe even 2 weeks into college, you're already like, I gotta turn away from that thing because I see where it's headed and it's not good. And you know who is good? It's Jesus. So what needs to change? And it won't be overnight. It'll be over time. And that's what we get to do together this semester. We get to talk about these things. We get to talk about what it looks like to live faithfully for Jesus in college, in exile, in Babylon. We'll fill those things out the whole semester. We'll keep talking about it. Let me just pray for us as we kind of wrap this part of things up. And Jesus, I thank you that we have a space to come and consider these questions. That we have a space to wrestle with who we are and who we want to be and who we want to give our allegiance to and pledge our loyalty to. And God, I just ask increasingly for myself and for my friends here tonight that our answer to those questions would be, we want to give our allegiance to you, King Jesus, no other king. Help us to see that Jesus, King Jesus, you are the only king worth building our lives on. It's in your name we pray. Amen.